russi lilla spelade för fyra och fem. Och russi lilla spelade för konungen som en russi lilla. Så träder hon så lätt upp på tiljan. Det voro två herrar som lade ihop ett rå. Vad ska nu russi lilla för spelandet få, russi lilla? Så träder hon så lätt upp på tiljan. Nu ska russi lilla för spelandet få, ty hon ska aldrig jungfru ifrån oss vilja gå, russi lilla. Så träder hon så lätt upp på tiljan.
A million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
We all want our kids to grow up safe and healthy, so we show them how, and we tell them, with honest conversations that let them know what we expect. That's especially important when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. Kids need to know the dangers and how to avoid them. And when it comes to pain medications, opioids, they need to know that they should never be taken without a prescription and never shared with friends or family. It's dangerous and illegal. So talk with your kids, because when you talk, they hear you.
It's Ebony Spectrum here on WRCT Pittsburgh. Here's Roland Martin.
All right, folks. I have been saying for quite some time that initiatives that are critically important to black folks are going to be under attack. My whole book, White Fear, How the Browning of America is Making White Folks Lose Their Minds, detail that. And what we have seen over the past several years, we've seen the attack on Black Lives Matter. We've seen the attack on what it means to be woke. We've seen the attack on CRT. Now we're seeing the wholesale attack on DEI. This is a well-funded effort to go after all of these programs. It wasn't just about the affirmative action decision that applied to colleges and universities. It's also the various programs that are happening in corporate America. Affinity groups are going to be under attack. I'm telling y'all, these things are coming. So the question really is, what should the response be? Black folks in corporate America, what should they be doing? African Americans who are board members, what should they be doing? So I had this conversation with my man Bruce Gordon, who's longtime executive at Verizon. When he retired from Verizon, he became president and CEO for the NAACP, lasted there a year. I really think they made a huge mistake, really not leaving him at the helm for longer than that. He joins us right now. So glad to see you, Bruce, to chat about this. First and foremost, how do you, just from your perspective, as someone who has been at the top of the game in corporate America, you sat on boards of directors, you're interfacing. What are you hearing from folks? Are they willing? Do they understand what the attacks are and what we're about to see over the next 6 months, a year, 2 years?
So, Roland, thanks for having me, one. And two, let me just take that word perspective and put a little context, more context on it. Because my perspective is a product of 53 years in the corporate environment. My perspective started in 1968 as a trainee. It ended in the C-suite in 2003, so that's a while ago, but I was running a $24 billion business. And then it finally ended in boardrooms, and I served on 8 corporate boards. So I've had a range of experience and a lot of perspective over the years. In terms of DE&I today, when I started, it was affirmative action. And it has morphed to DEI over that period of time. And as it's morphed, I think that the consistency that has existed in our community is that we should be pushing affirmative action and its predecessor DEI or its successor DEI because it's good for Black folks. We need it for our community. I don't debate that. But I think the more relevant discussion is corporations need us. DEI is not something that just serves our interest. It serves the bottom line of corporations and their interest. And as we think about this and as we address this movement in the country, in certain states that are trying to, quote, outlaw DEI, we should understand, and corporations need to understand, that this doesn't just hurt our community. It hurts their bottom line. And they need to take it as seriously as they take other policy issues, like, for instance, tax policy. So just understand that that's a perspective that I have. And it's a belief that I have that we, as the Black workforce, labor market, talent pool, however you want to characterize it, we're good, we're talented, we're capable. And we don't just need corporations to hire us. Corporations need us to be better. Let me just start by saying that. What do I hear?
Well, on that,
go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, what I was saying is that, you know, some people might say, you know, who's this old guy you have on here, Roland? You know, Bruce Gordon started in 68, 78 years old. How current is he? Does he have a perspective that is relevant today? I think so, but let your viewers be the judge of that. Because I'm not in the boardroom anymore. Been gone for three years. But here's what I think. I think that companies, corporations, created a policy on their own in 2019 about what corporations should do. So it's not just my opinion of what corporations should be doing. It's what corporations have said they should be doing. And they released a statement with a lot of fanfare back in 2019, and they basically said that it is the purpose of a corporation to promote an economy that serves all Americans. The head of the BRT, the Business Roundtable, said the American dream is alive but fraying. These modern principles that they were announcing reflect the business community's unwavering commitment to continue to push for an economy that serves all people. So if corporations believe that, and they've said it proactively, not reactively, then they need to put some muscle and some action behind these words and make sure that those who would take away DEI and affirmative action don't win that fight.
And speaking of that, the lawsuit against the Fearless Fund, Ed Bloom's group, he let the affirmative action case the Supreme Court decided. I know for a fact that several companies have begun pulling their money from them. I got to set up another meeting with them to talk about that, because I said to them, black folks didn't know who those companies are, because I dare say that in this battle is the wrong time for companies to be pulling out. Those companies, if they believe in the Fearless Fund before the lawsuit, should be standing with them and not withdrawing their money, because those same companies, they want black folks buying their products. And I dare say this is a moment of drawing in the sand. This is where white corporate leaders are going to have to make a clear decision. Are you a real ally, and are you going to look other white folks in the eye who want to stop these programs and say, no, you're wrong, and we are going to continue these type of programs? That's really the moment that we are in.
So the word that I like to use is commitment. Words are one thing, commitment's another. We have seen corporate leaders, we have seen corporations who identify what they believe to be policies that are not in their best interest. We have seen those corporations go to the mat. They spend billions of dollars with lobbying teams, with Washington offices, with offices in state capitals, where they are constantly badgering state and local and federal officials to implement policies that they believe to be in their best interest. If they have volunteered to say that they believe diversity is a source of competitive advantage, and they've said that, if they volunteered to say that they are in business to serve all communities, and they've said that, then they need to put the same energy behind tax policy as they do behind the whole issue of diversity, equity, and inclusion. That said, sometimes it takes a while for policies to shift. We know that the political process does not always move as quickly as it should. While corporations were waiting for tax policy to go their way, they were also finding ways around it. They had an effective tax rate versus an actual tax rate, versus a legislated tax rate. They found ways around it. They have tax accountants, they have tax attorneys, and they learn to manage their way through restrictions that are not in their best interest. They need to apply that same degree of commitment and energy towards addressing this issue of diversity in America. I think some of them have the stomach for that. Others may not. And I think where you were headed was, what's the role and responsibility of black folks who are in the C-suite, who are in the boardrooms? What's their role in all of this? But you tell me, should we go there?
Because that is the thing for me. I've directly said to Michael Hyder, who heads the ELC, Mike, we need you leading. We need the Black Economic Alliance. We need the Black Economic Forum. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I'm sorry. I am not seeing civil rights groups being effective on this. This is where our black corporate groups, folks that deal with economics, the U.S. Black Chamber, Inc., this is where they have to step up, lead the effort, and then also calling in those white women, calling in Latinos, saying, hey, this ain't just about us. Y'all going to be affected as well. And so this is where there has to be, to me, a forceful pushback and a defense and going on the offense in what we're seeing, as opposed to, hey, let's fall back, stay quiet, and see how it shakes out. It's clear what is coming our way, and it is a train, and they're going to go after every single program. We already see it for law school students. They're going to go after every – they're going after a scholarship named after George Floyd. This thing is going to go after every single initiative up and down that has impacted African-Americans and others, and we better understand what they're trying to do, and it's clear, and they are not being shy about it.
So I chose a career in corporate America because I believed at the time that the civil rights movement was going to move to a different venue, and that was the venue of work, and believed at the time that getting inside that game, accumulating power and influence that would affect policy, that would in fact ultimately benefit our community, was something worth trying to do. I believed that when I started, and I believed that throughout my career. Let's talk a little bit about engagement and who needs to be engaged and how, because I sort of describe it as a 360-degree effort. Clearly, what happens in the boardroom is very impactful in terms of what companies choose to do in matters of policy. In this case, we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and black economic growth and development. So the boardroom matters. The C-suite matters. And the workforce matters, because you just referred to affinity groups. Affinity groups, if functioning the way they were initially intended, and I consider myself to be a founder of that whole affinity group concept, all of those parties need to be engaged. So the difference between life in corporate America in 68 versus 2024 is that we have presence. We have black CEOs. We have black C-suite members. We have black board members. And the workforce looks a lot better in terms of our representation today than it did then. So we might argue that we don't have all the power we want, but we have one hell of a lot of power, and it's time to step up and use it. Don't say you want to be in a boardroom if once you find your way in there, you are going along to get along. Take a strong position. Don't say that you want to be in the C-suite if once you get there, you collect a paycheck, but you forget whose shoulders you stood on to arrive there in the first place. And something that everybody at every level needs to understand in the corporate America hierarchy, and some might think I'm crazy when I say this, but you got to be willing to get fired. You got to be willing to get kicked out. If you believe in a position that's in the best interest of our people, then you got to be willing to get fired. I know, Roland, I mean, this is fact. I know that there were two times when there was a concerted effort in my company to fire me. I know that. I saw the documentation. I had the discussions. But I also felt, given my initial attitude about joining corporate America, that if I was going to do what I said I was going to do, I had to take that risk. I think that one of the downsides of the success economically that a significant segment of our community has had in terms of finding employment in large corporations, climbing the ladder, finding their way into the C-suite, managing to be in boardrooms, collecting board fees, is there's a tendency to get a little comfortable. There's a tendency to to go along and get along. There's a tendency not to want to make people uncomfortable. In my opinion, that's the reason we're there. That's our
yes. Reason.
So there is, and I don't want to sound the least bit judgmental, because I know plenty of folks who are doing just that. Maybe not as many as I'd like. Maybe there's not 100% participation, but there are plenty of folks who understand who they are, where they are, and what their roles and responsibilities are. And to your point, we need those folks now more than ever.
The reason I started laughing, because I've often said, I started every job with the premise I was going to get fired anyway. I said, listen, three things can happen. Either you leave on your own volition for another job, you stay there until you retired, or you get fired. And I've always said, look, I'm going to say what I need to say while I'm there. I always say I couldn't stand parking lot militants. And that's the black folks who got a whole lot to say when you're in the parking lot. But then when you go in the building, they ain't got nothing to say. And then you look around and like, well, what the hell? I'm the only one talking. You were talking all that smack in the parking lot. Don't be a parking lot militant. And the thing about when we talk about not just the C-suite folks, but also board members. And I've had this conversation with John Rogers and others as well. And I'm sitting there going, black folks fought like hell to get black board members. John H. Johnson and Earl Graves and Reverend Jesse Jackson Sr. and so many others. And I've said to black board members, if black folks are not getting more contracts, professional services, outside law firms, outside accounting firms, you got black catering companies, black-owned media, black PR companies. We can go on and on and on. I'm like, if you have not had a material impact on increasing business to black people, then what are you doing? And it's not just you there to collect stock options and you feel good and you get to send your kids to private school and you only benefit. And that to me is I think black board members today must have that reminder of, while you're there, what changed while you were there? And it's not just a question of, well, I really can't do much. I said, no, you can do a lot more if you want to. And I think we have to be constantly challenging one another to say we must be doing more beyond, not as Dr. King said, not as individuals, but operating in the collective.
So you and I both know John well enough to know that John gets it. And that John and his colleagues have for, I don't know, maybe 15, 18 years now, gathered black directors in an annual conference for the purpose of making sure that they accept their roles and responsibilities as advocates for black economic growth and development in this country. So there clearly are those who get it. Let me tell you a quick story, if I can, that sort of represents the model that I think works best, because I still think it takes us all. So, as you know, John and Melody have years been fighting, in some respects, just to get a percentage point of the capital that is deployed through pension funds and other corporate capital allocation decision making. And while there's been some progress, it's really not been enough. We had that problem at Verizon. We were not spending what we should have. We were not allocating as we should have to funds like Ariel. Well, in the boardroom was Hugh Price, who was the former head of the Urban League. In the C-suite was Bruce Gordon. And in a very key role that I'll come to in a minute was another brother. So Hugh was asking the question in the boardroom, what are we doing with our pension fund management? Asking the CEO and his fellow board members. So he raised the issue and put a spotlight on it and pushed for results. While he was doing his thing in the boardroom, and appropriately so, I became a gateway, because I was not in the CFO's organization. I was running a business. But people got to know who I was and that I was in the C-suite. So they came to me and they said, we're having a difficult time trying to get access to Verizon's pension fund. Can you help us? So I would take those persons. I didn't take them all, because I too tried to screen to make sure we were getting the best and the brightest. And when I saw a really talented person, then I went to our CFO, who's a white guy, but an ally, and said, I need you to have this company considered for allocation. The secret in that whole equation was the screener who made the decisions, the person who interviewed these firms and made the recommendation as to whether or not they were worthy or not was a brother. His name was Conrad Francis. So ultimately, from Hugh to Bruce to Conrad, with help from Fred, CFO, and Bill, the pension fund executive, we went from effectively zero to a billion. And we did that in probably 2.5 years. But it took the whole alignment. What couldn't just be Hugh in the boardroom, couldn't just be Bruce in the C-suite, couldn't just be Conrad, who was in middle management. It took all of us. And it took a little bit of Jesse Jackson at the Wall Street Initiative raising that same topic in a different community, but the same relevant audience. That's how things get done. And I think we sometimes spend too much time pointing a finger at one player in that game and saying, why aren't you doing your job? Instead of recognizing that it's got to be a collaborative. And then to your point, Roland, when you look at the civil rights groups, you have to ask the question, are they too raising these issues? Are they too putting the kind of advocacy pressure that they are able to put on the equation? It takes us all, and we need to collaborate and get it done.
Absolutely. Hold tight 1 second. I got to go into a quick break. We come back. My panel has questions. We're chatting with Bruce Gorton. Folks, I'm sounding this alarm because I need everybody who is listening to understand what is at stake. This is not Boy Who Cried Wolf. I'm telling you, what is happening right now, and I've had this conversation with numerous people, we're talking about millions and billions of dollars that are at stake. We're talking about support for HBCUs and other initiatives. I'm telling y'all, this thing is real, and the attacks are going to continue. We must be prepared for it. We're chatting with Bruce Gorton, retired Verizon executive. He sat on a number of corporate boards, also was a CEO of the NAACP. Let's go to my panel. Greg Carr, you're up first.
Thank you, Roland, and thank you, Brother Gorton, for a very enlightening and important conversation. As you probably know, the law school at Howard was renamed recently for Vernon Jordan, who, of course, has a very complicated legacy. And so I appreciate you being very thoughtful in dealing with this question of individual achievement as distinct from working together. My question has to do with what you think of, is the long arc of the mission and of what these folks are trying to do. I'm thinking about it because of the deep pockets that are currently trying to shape the contours of American society and beyond. Of course, we know real affirmative action. Jared Kushner with his affinity fund, with all this money coming from outside the United States, clearly they have a global agenda at work. My question really is, is this effort to suppress non-white folk, including poor whites, in fact, is this sustainable? I'm thinking about the attack on HBCUs in particular and how now they seem to not just be satisfied with trying to eliminate DEI and white spaces, but trying to restructure black spaces as well by saying that you can't perhaps even consider race in, for example, admissions criteria at places like Howard or Meharry or Morehouse College of Medicine, School of Medicine, medical schools. Is this sustainable, this all-out assault on non-whiteness?
That's a great question, and my answer will or will not disappoint you. I think it is sustainable. I think that the threat is, for our community, an existential threat. I think it's deep-seated. I think it is funded by the wealthy and the white poor. It is a coalition with incredible power and influence. And yes, I think it is sustainable. That doesn't mean that I think we can't come out on top. That doesn't mean that I don't think we can do something to curb and reverse their momentum. But we should view it with enormous concern. I don't think Roland is being hyperbolic at all with how he's described the circumstance. But you know, the question becomes, what's at the root of it? Why? Mm-hmm. That's complicated, but to say the least. But I think there are two things in play that end up sort of complementing each other. I think for those who have achieved some level of wealth in this country and who believe in their right to pass on their wealth to the generations that follow, it's an economic issue. And they believe that to the extent that they control the economy, they control wealth distribution, they have policies in place that protect them, so to speak, secure them, that that is ultimately an outcome that they desire. So to be fair about this, I don't think all white folks are like that, but there are plenty. So that's one thing. The other thing, and call me crazy, but we on this call, we know how this country was founded. And we knew who was in charge and who was in the fields. And there's a certain segment, a large segment, unfortunately, of our fellow Americans who would just as soon have it go back to that and believe that was the right way to run this country. So there is racism is alive and well in America, and we should never doubt it. The battle for wealth and the retention of wealth and the distribution of wealth is also alive and well. And I think it's those two things that sort of collaboratively create the momentum that puts this at risk. So yes, I think to the extent that these two forces continue to collaborate, it's a sustainable movement and we should be worried about it. Not undefeatable, but certainly sustainable. Is that fair?
That's more than fair. Thank you. Thank you, Brother Gordon. Thank you.
Racy.
Mr. Gordon, thank you for being here with us. My question is, how do we get people who I think to some degree rightfully view the DEI programs and the whole umbrella of DEI as merely cosmetic changes that haven't moved the needle much in terms of Black progress and has done more for white women than it has for Black people? How do we get those folks to see that this attack on DEI is not necessarily just about eliminating programs that people may or may not feel are effective for different reasons, but really is about turning back the clock on racial progress, and that we need to have a sense of urgency around this movement, as you put it, as opposed to just being a little apathetic about particular individual programs going away.
And your question, if I make sure I understand, is how do we in our community?
Yeah, how do we get our community to kind of get off the sidelines, get our community, people that don't perceive DEI programs as really having moved the needle for us, to see that whether or not they feel like those programs are effective, a larger movement is at play to roll back racial progress?
So, you know, one of the things that I wonder is whether DEI is an acronym. If you did a survey of our community, whether more than half of our community would even recognize it as a term. Because think of where it is most frequently talked about, in higher education and in corporate America. And the majority of our community don't find themselves in either of those places. So it's one concern I have is in terms of raising the awareness, it may not be a kitchen table topic that gets their attention. They're more concerned, those of us less fortunate than us, those assembled on this call, they're more concerned about feeding their families today. They're more concerned about getting their kids educated. There are more fundamental issues, more survival-like issues that I think have their attention. So that's not to say that we shouldn't be educating those who don't get it, but I think we need to segment our community of Black folks and really ask the question, what are the issues that are most important to each segment? Because we're not a homogenous group. And I'm not sure, not satisfied, that we address our broader community in the sophisticated, segmented way that we need to. I'm not sure I'm answering your question well, but...
That was actually perfect. I wholeheartedly agree with you. Thank you.
Okay.
Law Victoria Burke.
Hey, Ms. Gordon, nice talking to you. With everything that we're seeing right now, can you name anyone who's doing it right? Maybe two or three companies that are actually doing well with DEI that you're saying to yourself, wow, they're standouts at a time when we're getting all this pushback?
I'm sort of 3 years removed, so I may not be as current as I should be. Let me say two things. One, I do worry that as a general trend, people in my generation, so people who left corporate America in the last 10, 15 years, were beginning to worry that the pipeline of Black talent coming behind us to succeed us, we were concerned that there wasn't enough there, not because there weren't qualified people, but because those pipelines weren't being cultivated as aggressively as they needed to be. That said, on a positive note, if you look at representation in boardrooms and C-suite, we're doing somewhat better. So who has been doing it well? I will tell you that that Verizon has had a good track record. If you look at the diversity on the Verizon board, it's as diverse a board as any that you'll see anywhere in the country. If you look at their senior team and look at recent appointments, it's moving in the right direction. Their lead independent director is an African American. So I'm sure I'm biased, and I'll acknowledge that. But Verizon has a pretty good track record. I served on the board of Northrop Grumman. That company, when I arrived there, in my opinion, was not as progressive as it needed to be. The CEO who stepped in shortly after my arrival made an absolute and total commitment to diversity. He built it into the compensation of a senior executive team. He established very specific, measurable outcomes that would affect the bonuses of his senior executives based upon whether they were achieved or not. And a significant amount of progress was made, at least during my tenure on that board. So I do see companies that are making progress. I do see companies that are doing the right things. And if you ask me, so what are they? Because I think that's the more what are the elements that make a DEI initiative work, program work? It's one, it's talked about in the boardroom. It's a board agenda topic, and it is talked about consistently. One. Two, senior executives have their pay affected by their ability to achieve the goals that are set by the company in the area of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And by the way, I should have preceded that by saying there are specific measurable goals set on diversity, equity, and inclusion. One element that has crept into this discussion around diversity that sort of clouds the issue is the term people of color. Because often you'll see reports and analysis and it'll talk about people of color, and they're all lumped into one category, which is an easy way to present, interpret the numbers to suggest how well an organization is doing. And some companies were starting to understand that and starting to disaggregate people of color so that you could be very specific about progress made with Black, brown, and yellow people. So those are some of the techniques that I think matter. At the end of the day, pay for performance is a big factor in getting companies and leaders of companies to take diversity, equity, and inclusion seriously. I hope that's helpful.
One of the things that I've made. Go ahead, Bruce. I'm sorry.
I was just saying. I'm saying it too late. But you guys make me feel like an old man when you say Mr. Gordon. So Bruce is good with me. Go ahead, Roman.
Well, trust me, when people call me Mr., I say this. I say, listen, I'm rolling. My daddy is Mr. Martin. He's 77 this month. And I'm 55. So I understand. I understand your point. Here's the thing final comment, because one of the things that I have been doing is, and you know, we're still trying to get the Black Economic Alliance on the show. I made it clear to Michael Heido, look, EOC, want you on the show, and the rest of these people, because I know what I'm seeing. I know what I'm hearing, and I understand the landscape, because I also understand history. And the reality is, in American history, anytime there's a period of Black success, it's been followed by white backlash. And those 8 years of Obama pissed off a lot of people. I knew what the heck was coming. The lawsuits are in front of us. These things are there. And so what I'm saying to folks is understand what we're going up against is a well-funded, well-organized effort because they recognize that the demographics of this country are changing. And what we cannot afford is to be complacent, is to be comfortable. I look at all of these companies that announce these billions of dollars in commitments post-George Floyd, and I have said to the Urban League, the NAACP, and Reverend Al Sharpton's NAN, to Rainbow Push, now under Freddie Haynes, that we should be calling those people to the carpet by saying, if you promised $100 billion, then you should be spending the $100 billion. We should be challenging them on Black-owned advertising, challenging them in every place, because, again, a lot of these companies, they want our money. They want us buying their products, but there's a return on investment when it comes to that. And that, to me, Dr. King said that in his final sermon on April 3rd, 1968, when he said that we're fighting for sanitation workers and we must redistribute the pain. He said, those who do not do business with Black people, we do not do business with them. And that, to me, is how we also get their attention, because the last thing they'd want is for us, to, as King said on April 3rd, is to withdraw our money. And that, to me, is the most powerful weapon that we have. Bruce, final comments.
I want to really close out with some comments, Roland, about the organizations, because you've said it a couple times, and I understand. And there's no question that these are organizations that are in a position to make a difference. So the ELC, I've said this to leaders of the ELC. I've been a member of the ELC. But I have, for a long time, believed that ELC punches below its weight. And I think by having Black C-suite membership and having the kind of numbers and the kind of access that ELC has to the corporations that are represented in its membership body, I do believe that ELC is punching below its weight. And while it's done some very positive things, it could be far more impactful than it has been. And since I have been a member of ELC, so that I'm not casting dispersions, I could have done a better job too, and I'm not happy with where things are today. Black Economic Alliance, you and I have talked about BEA. It's a relatively young organization. As you know, I'm one of the founding board members, advisory board member today. Frankly, the organization in a short period, because it was only founded in 2017, has gotten a lot accomplished. And in terms of its mission of having a voice in policymaking, particularly at the presidential level, much of the Joe Biden platform in 2020 was influenced significantly by input from the Black Economic Alliance. So I still am optimistic that it will continue to grow, continue to develop, and continue to be impactful. and probably needs to do an even better job of making folks aware of who they are. And then the third organization
that
doesn't get talked about nearly as much as I wanted to be talked about is the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. In my opinion, it is the single most important civil rights organization in our country. And the work that they do in the judicial system at the federal, state, and local level is unparalleled. It too needs support. It needs funding. A good amount of the post-George Floyd murder commitments actually went to LDF. I know that I was helpful in making some of that happen. And I just want to make sure that as we as a community look at our organizations, we should critique those who are underperforming. We should encourage those who are trying to become good performers. And we should cheer for the ones who are delivering day in and day out. And yep. The Legal Defense Fund is delivering for our community, and we all need to get behind it and support it.
Well, I'll tell you, look, we call them often to get Janae Nelson on this show. We've had some of the other lawyers that have been involved in their cases on the show. We also are constantly, when Christian Clark led the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, and also now Damon Hewitt, and I'm often saying that our legal groups have played a huge role. And so I absolutely believe in elevating them. And the reason, you know, when I'm calling all of these folks and I'm saying, look, we want you to come on because don't just talk to CNN or talk to MSNBC. Our people need to realize that these groups exist and the work that they're doing. And because if our people understand this, and when somebody says, well, man, folk not doing nothing, we can then say, wait a minute, hold up. They were just on the show. This is what they're doing. They're doing this. They're doing that. And so I believe there is, it's important that our folks absolutely know that, understand that. And so we're going to continue, which is why I'm constantly, you know, some of these people, I got some folks, they mad out here when I'm pressing them on the advertising front. But I'm clear that if we're not getting our fair share of dollars, we can't build Black-owned media to be what it needs to be able to hire more reporters and tell more of these stories. And we've got to have that because if we're waiting on somebody else to cover our story, we're going to be waiting a long time. And so we got to be able to marshal our forces and get them to understand, hey, here's what's coming down the pipeline. Let's get prepared. And so that's really what our objective is.
Well, let me tell you something. I know what you're doing. I know how long you've been doing it. You are committed beyond commitment, and I appreciate you, brother. Just keep up the fight, which, by the way, I know you will, regardless of whether I encourage you to do it or not, because that's just Roland Martin.
So I ran into I saw Chris Williams. He's here at Augusta National. He's a member, and I ran to Fred Terrell. I was joking with Fred, and Fred said, he said, man, somebody told me they would try to get you to pipe down. I said, Fred, if there's one thing that's guaranteed, I ain't going to never pipe down. I said, somebody has to say the stuff the other folk don't want to say. I said, that's going to be me. So and he just busted out laughing at that. Bruce, I appreciate it, man. Thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Roland. Be well.
Here's Karen Hunter on O.J. Simpson.
O.J., Sneaky just up and died yesterday. Ain't nobody know it. Wait a minute, Smiz. I think it's too soon. I think we're going to have to wait at least until tomorrow before you could play that clip. But there is a lot of reclamation, which we're going to talk about later. I'm not going to engage unless you want to jump in. But I remember where I was when the verdict came down because I acted like a total fool running around the Daily News newsroom. High-fiving myself, apparently, as white women huddled in the corners crying, and I was confused. I was so confused. I thought everybody would be as relieved as I was that a black man was found not guilty of killing a white woman in America. I couldn't believe it was happening. I was in my, you know, how old was I? It was 1995. I was young. I was young, y'all. wasn't even out of my 20s, right? Running around like a chicken with her head cut off. And then I ran into a bunch of people crying. And I was like, oh, for them, this is different. And it was, to me, the first time America got to peek into the window of, you know, how divided this nation really is along racial lines, because HBCU campuses erupted in cheers, mm-hmm. predominantly white campuses, tears. And OJ became this kind of polarizing figure and a weird thing that we would defend. I think he was our first R. Kelly, you know, like where we would defend him because after all, no matter how problematic he was, found not guilty, found responsible later, ended up going to jail for, I guess, trying to get his stuff back, his Heisman Trophy and things. But he was one of the greatest football players, college at least, of all time. But a very complicated man, spent a lot of time on social media, which was weird to me, watching it play out. But he made transition yesterday, and he had been battling cancer, which I didn't know. I don't think many people knew. Where were you? Do you remember? You must have been a baby when OJ was
95. Okay, 9, 10, 11, 12, 7 years old. I was 7. But I remember the white Bronco because my mom was in law school at the time. And they had left. We were in Massachusetts at that point, and they had left law school to watch the chase. And I didn't know what I was looking at that time, but my dad was like, we should be recording this. He's like, this is historical. And so I was like, okay. So I remember getting the little VHS and putting it in and hitting record. And as a family, just watching that car chase, it really was historical. It really was. And also from an attorney's perspective, Johnny Cochran, that made his career.
If it don't fit, you must acquit. Yes.
That made his career. And so, yeah, it was historical for so many reasons. And some consider him famous and some consider him infamous. But what a way to pass. Cancer is just awful. It's awful.
No, it is.
So wishing him well.
Yeah. My dad and many of us, nobody, I think, has been immune from having cancer touch their lives through a loved one. You know, so I'm not, you know, going, you know, this is not that time. But I just want to, you know, talk about the touch points in American history and OJ, the Bronco, the white Bronco. It was the trial, the glove. It was the dog. It was Cato Caitlin. It was Marsha Clark and Chris Darden and Judge Ito. It was the black women on the jury that they mistakenly thought would be mad because he was with a white woman and didn't understand the racial politics of America, that a black woman would not find that man guilty. They mistook us. And that was interesting as well. Born in Southern San Francisco, California in July 9th, 1947, changed how athletes were viewed. You know, he was in airplane and running through the airport, jumping over suitcases for Hertz and just beautiful. I knew him from the Jet magazine with his first wife, Marguerite, because they were so beautiful. They had a beautiful little family, you know, and it was like,
first of all, I miss Jet magazine because I really, my goal in life was to be one of the Jet beauties of the week.
Okay, I can see that.
Beauty of the week. Are you kidding? I used to just scroll and be like, what's she wearing? What she got on? Oh my God, fantastic. I actually have them all on my face. Oh my God, I miss Jet. I miss Jet so much. How can we bring it back? How can we do a biopic about Jet?
I don't think we can. People don't even look at newspapers anymore, let alone have a magazine come to their house with their name on it and taking pictures out. You know, it was right on magazine. We had magazines that my mama still, I still got a magazine from my mother from the 1970s. She kept all of the Ebonys and Jets. I'm like, ma'am.
Hey, y'all, what's up? It's Friday, so I'm going to keep it black. But I'm going to keep it brief. It would seem as though I've got to call you people in again. And you people, as in my people. Look like to me y'all didn't get enough last week. So bring that ass here, boy. Why on earth was y'all shucking and jiving down to the Chick-fil-A on Martin Luther King Jr. Drive to perform a minstrel show for Donald Trump? I know all of us seen Maya Angelou say, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. But it don't give comprehension. On the way to a fundraiser here in Buckhead, Donald Trump carried his cracking ass down to the Chick-fil-A in the West End. Now, for anybody who's ever been to Atlanta, you know good and goddamn well there is no reason you should ever need to pass through the West End to get to Buckhead from Hartsfield-Jackson. But he decided to stop there anyway to take pictures with the staff and give out free milkshakes to customers. I bet money he wanted to give out free chicken. But somebody on his team said, now that's a little bit too on the nose. I think they'll find us out if we give the inner city blacks free chicken. But it gets worse. This was a Chick-fil-A right behind the Atlanta University Center, home to Spelman, Morehouse, Clark Atlanta, and Morris Brown, where some of the country's brightest black minds are being molded into tomorrow's thinkers, leaders, and change agents, or so we thought. Because, baby, what the hell made you think it was okay to have a Spelman hand etched into the annals of history placed across this man's chest? And this baby is young, likely impressionable, and is literally being ostracized for this action in real life, so I will not condone or participate in bullying her. But there needs to be serious consideration that, sure, Spelman College is not an institution that is decidedly Democrat or Republican, especially with this new generation looking to dismantle the two-party system, which is largely made up of college students. But also considering the fact that we just celebrated 143 years of the existence of Spelman as the maker for black women's empowerment and the academic home of several black feminist icons, what we won't do is allow that heritage to be juxtaposed next to a walking antithesis of black women's liberation. And it wasn't just her. Apparently, a young girl from Clark, Atlanta took it upon herself to say on camera, this is Spelman, this is Clark, this is Morehouse, and this is Morris Brown, and we support you, Mr. Trump. Who is we, sister? What really made me gag, as in like throw up in my mouth a little bit, was seeing more than one slide of young black women clinging to this man's person with perceivable glee. But once again, these are just kids, and we can only hope that the social ramifications of this stunt will help them learn from their actions. But the actions displayed yesterday are but a microcosm of the way a lot of y'all be acting when it comes to fame and fanfare, particularly associated with Donald Trump. Let him offer you something, and all of his atrocities go out the window. He's done the same thing at black churches. He's done it at other HBCUs. He did it with those two very misguided black women, Dominant Silk, parading them around his 2020 campaign as his hype women. He so very obviously uses black people as pawns to siphon votes from unsuspecting populations that he suspects don't take elections seriously enough to have an opinion in the first place. And I'm increasingly concerned that some of you can't see that we are falling to the same trap that was laid in 2016, or that you simply do not care. And right now, today, we cannot afford to be careless with our allegiance or frivolous with his representation. Well, him being president really didn't affect me. He was shelling out those stimulus checks, so he good in my book. Say it with me. No, he did not. It was a lie. Congress said that you needed the money and he wanted to say fuck y'all for real. And even if you don't care that it wasn't necessarily his idea, what you do need to know is that his ideas are the ones that are making your everyday life terrible. The whole time you worried about a check that was gone, what, 2 weeks later? Exhibit A, his 2017 tax bill has steadily increased taxes for anyone making less than $75,000 a year, which is why everybody you know was looking at their refunds or lack thereof crazy this year. Exhibit B, Trump appointed three conservative Supreme Court justices to the roster and now y'all dodged the law trying to get an abortion. Women lost their reproductive rights with the overturn of Roe v. Wade. Minorities lost a supposed fair shot at higher education when they took affirmative action. Businesses have been given the right to discriminate against people on the basis of their gender and sexuality. The Voting Rights Act has been weakened, and any attempt at canceling student loan debt has been blocked at every turn. Up until recently, I guess Joe did that one thing. But they've already told you they're going for our civil rights next. And Trump has already told y'all if elected, he'll do everything he can to make sure it's the last election we've ever had. But you thought it was cute to give the backwater racists that live down the street from you even more rhetorical ammunition to support his delusions of grandeur to rid us of a free election. Public opinion can sway elections, everybody. That's quite literally how it works. That's why celebrity endorsements are so important. Yes, there are people that are always going to vote for him. And while the inverse is true as well, stuff like this not only rally his base, but can also sway undecided voters. But you know what else it does? Perhaps the most important consequence is not only having people vote for somebody who should literally be in jail, much less allowed to run, but it also influences people who know nothing about local candidates and will either make their whole ballot Republican in November or Christmas tree it. Tennessee Senate just passed a bill allowing public school faculty and staff to carry concealed handguns instead of just getting rid of the automatic weapons. The Arizona Supreme Court just reinstated an abortion ban from 1864. This social media shit has real life consequences. We're in a time where at least 50% of adults in the United States get at least some of their news from social media. And doing something that may seem as frivolous as grabbing a photo op with Donald Trump is empowering the people across our states who have the actual factual plans and means to take away our rights and freedoms. So for those of you who feel like you don't actually have a dog in this fight and will do anything for a TV moment, I need you to think twice, three, hell, maybe even four times about what you do in the public eye. Because as unserious as the place social media can be, it's time for all of us to be fucking for real.
And finally, about Candace Owens.
I personally think this Candace Owens pivot is some type of smokescreen, and I'm going to break down why. Now, I could be wrong, but this is just what I think. And far be it for me to speak on her. I don't even like to talk about her, but I feel like I have to for several reasons. Because one, I don't trust anybody who willingly tokenizes themselves. And she's literally made a career out of doing just that. I also don't trust anybody who seeks approval from the morally inept, which she also does. And I don't trust anyone who's willing to throw their community under the bus for the validation of the melanin deficient. And I won't overlook that. Two, I'm starting to see my community do what we tend to do. And it bothers me. We got to stop this now. We have this tendency to disregard or overlook problematic behaviors of certain people when we find a stance or an opinion that we agree with. And I'm starting to see it happen. It always starts off real simple, like, I can't believe I'm actually agreeing with her. And then everybody laughs. And then it becomes, you know what? I've been agreeing with everything she's been saying lately, which is a gross exaggeration. It's been two things. And everything else she said has been wrong. And then it eventually becomes, you know what? I don't think she's all that bad. I think people are hating. And then you open yourself up to being influenced by people that you knew initially not to trust. We don't need to get to that point. Now, most people seem to think that she's doing this because she lost her standing. And it could be, you know, the white adjacency that used to serve her is no longer serving her. So she could be seeking out a sense of community over here, or she's just trying to remain relevant. I don't know. But I think it's more sinister. We have to factor in that this is one of the most pivotal election years in recent history. And people are politically wavering more than they have in recent history because a lot of people are unhappy with the current administration. This is a great time, politically speaking, for the left or right to steal votes from each other. And I think that's what's happening. If they can take a staunch Black Republican and make her seem relatable, that's going to influence Black people to potentially vote Republican. Why wouldn't they want to do that? The only time that they think about us and consider us is during these times. And as you can see, that's what's going on. Trump is selling sneakers that are supposed to appeal to Black people. And then we have him selling Bibles. The best way to appeal to us in America, Black people, it's through religion. We already know this. Religion is a tool and it has been weaponized against us forever, and it still is. And honestly, you guys, if you really think about it, Black people are a lot more conservative than we tend to recognize. If it weren't for racism being a factor, we would have a lot more right-wing Black people than we do. But racism is so heavy in this country that it makes it a little harder to completely side with them. But it's definitely a possibility, and I think that they're trying to bridge that gap. They see that most Black people are liberal, leftists, or Democrats, and they're trying to break that because we're at a time now where everybody's like, I don't like what's going on with this current administration. It's a great time politically to try to steal votes, like I said, and I think that that might be a thing. And unfortunately, we have to factor in that even though we don't like her, she's still a Black person, which means that she still has the ability to tap in the way that we all do. But she's using it against us, and I don't like that. She's using it to play on us, which is also why I don't like platforms like The Shade Room and like The Breakfast Club, because they're giving these people who have been damaging to our community, people who have spewed the most hateful rhetoric about us as a whole, and dangerous rhetoric, a platform to speak. They're giving them a voice, which is basically allowing them to open up and appeal to the masses being their own community, being us. So you're willing to play on us because you know that having her on your show is going to spark controversy, which is going to get you more views, which gets you more money, but you're doing it at the expense of us potentially. I don't trust that. I don't trust them. I don't trust her. I don't trust the political climate. So I'm not going to sit here and just think that, oh, this is just because she wants to stay relevant. I think it's something deeper than that, because one thing I know about Republicans is they play the long game. They strategize. Nothing happens instantaneously with them. And that's the difference between them and Democrats. They actually work. They actually go in. They do what they want and they get what they want. And I really think that that's what we're seeing. Now, you guys may have different opinions, and I'm happy to hear them if you want to share them in the comments. But my point is, everybody keep your head on a swivel. Don't fall for silly tactics, y'all. Don't go for things that you can't trust. If you've gone your whole life or the whole time you've known her not trusting her, remain there. People don't just flip overnight. She didn't just come from the things that she said, especially about like George Floyd and us playing the race card, all these white supremacist talking points. You don't come from that to, I just want the best for us. It's time for us to take our standing. Everybody else is trying to divide us overnight. That's a tactic. Don't fall for it.
And that was Ari J in our last segment. We want to thank you for listening. Check us out next week. Peace.